Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. And last week, Starbucks announced that it's closing more than a dozen stores in particular areas in California, particular areas in Oregon, particular areas in Washington State and Washington, D.C. And there was some internal discussion featuring Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz that made its way into the public domain. And he said in no uncertain terms why the Starbucks had decided to close those 16 locations.
And I don't have to spend too much time on what's going on in the country and how America has become unsafe. But you all read the press release of the last couple of days about the fact that we are beginning to close stores that are not unprofitable. But we're closing stores as a result of the co-creation sessions that we've had, almost 60 now, 25 in the SSC and the rest in the field, and we had one yesterday in San Antonio. But in all of those sessions, it has shocked me that one of the primary concerns that our retail partners have is their own personal safety. And then we heard the stories that go along with it about what happens in our bathrooms. The issue of mental illness, the issues of homelessness, and the issues of crime. And Starbucks is a window into America. We have stores in every community, and we are facing things in which the stores were not built for. And so we're listening to our people and closing stores, and this is just the beginning. There are going to be many more.
Sure, because Ooh. Chicago's not on the list yet. Seattle, Portland, Philadelphia, L.A., D.C., what do they have in common?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Schultz went on to say this about, well, the state and local officials responsible for Seattle, Portland, Philadelphia, L.A., D.C.
And I must say, in my view, at the local, state, and federal level, these governments across the country and leaders, mayors and governors and city councils, have abdicated their responsibility in fighting crime and addressing mental illness. And we are going to have to refine and transform and modernize many of the things we do to meet the needs of our customers in a very changing operating environment in which customer behavior is changing. Now, I say that, but at the same time, you need to understand something. Despite the challenges of COVID and post-COVID, and the changes in customer behavior in which over 50% of the business is drive-through, over 25% of the business is mobile order and pay, and the third-place experience as it was designed seems to be less relevant, the demand for Starbucks coffee by our customers, domestically and around the world, has never been greater.
So not a demand issue, not a profitability issue, specifically and exclusively a safety issue.
And to some extent, a homeless issue, because homeless people sit in Starbucks and then they use their washrooms. And one time I went,
Also changing their bathroom policy, Starbucks is.
Yeah. Well, here in Chicago, you have to get a code and you have to be a customer in order to use the code to get into the bathroom.
I wouldn't know because I stopped going to Starbucks a long time ago. And this is the Starbucks under the leadership of Howard Schultz, who you may remember had a dalliance with running for president back in 2020. And, you know, is definitely a guy left of center. I mean, you remember, it's not that long ago when all 8,000 stores in the United States were closed one afternoon. That would have been May 29th of 2018 for racial bias education.
Oh, that's right.
So that your barista could have a conversation with you about race relations when you ordered your latte. How'd that go over? How'd that work out to increase the peace in these major cities where Howard Schultz is now closing stores?
You were working that day. Remember I stopped in and went through the drive-thru at Western and Addison there? And she's like, is there anything you want to talk about race? I'm like, no, I'm all right. How are you doing? Please give me a break. I just want my coffee, well, and I'm going to move on. But it was cute. I mean, they were trying. Nobody was trained. They didn't know what they were doing. Some chick with a nose ring is like, do you have anything race relations you'd like to discuss?
No, it's not cute. It's inane. It was inane.
Stupid.
And Howard Schultz, he's getting attention for what he said and what he's doing with respect to the stores because he's raising the specter of public safety and he's generically calling out local officials. People like Howard Schultz, sentimental barbarians like Howard Schultz, who would engage in the sort of corporate sophistry that he did some 4 years ago, are, of course, part of the problem on the landscape in America generally and in big cities specifically, aren't they? Oh, and by the way, making fewer headlines, but it's the same topic. Concerns over downtown crime forcing businesses to make changes. I mentioned this several weeks back on a Saturday night when the Viagra Triangle was shut down by 11 o'clock. Well, that's the new normal. We're having to pay out of our pocket to beef up security. Safety is key. People won't go out unless they feel safe, said Steve Hartenstein, who represents the Stefani Restaurants and the Illinois Restaurant Association. The Illinois Restaurant Association has also been god-awful.
Right.
Pathetic. Sam Toya, pathetic. Folded in with the COVIDians. Bootlickers to the power structure in Chicago. And this is what you get. Businesses in the downtown area have been closing earlier, bringing on security, while some workers are declining late-night shifts. Actually, a buddy of mine who owns a tavern in the city, on the last point, declining shifts. This kid who's like a great worker for him. Mm-hmm. I think he's in college or just out of college. He's like, you know, I got to go, you know, 25 minutes that way. Oh. And I won't even get into which neighborhoods. And so, you know, can I just do shifts? I got to be done before sundown. I can't work till 10 o'clock because it's too dangerous. Too dangerous for me going back home at that hour.
Yeah.
That's a commentary.
People are waking up to that. I don't want my kids out at dark. I don't want them taking the CTA even when it's light out.
Even Howard Schultz.
Yep. Yeah. He knows.
Jordan in Forest Park.
You know, I'm wondering what the employees of the 7-Eleven stores around the country are now thinking about how their management thinks about them. If a liberal corporation like Starbucks is concerned about the safety of their employees, even though they're profitable stores, how does that make you feel if you're an employee at a 7-Eleven, where that's probably the more common area where you're going to have a confrontation?
Well, okay. Or how about a Taco Bell? The CWB Chicago had videos circulating yesterday. I think it was on Saturday night.
Clark and Division.
At Clark and Division, Taco Bell, that was sort of a facsimile of the fry joint in New York that got hit with $20,000 in damages because three girls lost their minds when they had to pay a dollar for extra sauce or whatever the hell it was and tore up the place. Same thing happened at Clark and Division. People are throwing stuff and then somebody who works for Taco Bell comes out and throws something back. The place was up for grabs.
And CWB was, you know, they said if you throw an object at an employee, don't be surprised if they throw it right back at you, which is what they did.
Don't be surprised.
It was disgusting behavior.
Don't be surprised if you get something more than just an item thrown back at you, because that's what I would be. If it was my establishment.
What would you do?
Well, I wouldn't do anything. I'm like Rodney Dangerfield, Back to School. I got people to do the things I don't want to do.
Okay.
Michael on the South Side.
Good morning, Dan. Morning, Amy. Thank you for taking my call. Let's face it, Howard Schultz is a duplicitous scumbag. He should apologize to the manager at the Philadelphia Starbucks that he threw under the bus 4 years ago.
Oh, good point. Yeah, I forgot about that. Good one. Yeah, thanks for the call, Michael. Agreed. Howard Schultz, it's classic. They don't like the consequences of the policies they advocate. And that's Howard Schultz and Starbucks. Absolutely. Mary Kay, Western Springs.
Yes, excellent point there. Well, I make better coffee at my house than they make at Starbucks for sure. Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
Do you have a drive-through?
Yeah. In a bathroom, a public washroom.
I could make money that way. That's what I should do next. I haven't spent a dollar in that place in years because I just, you know, I'm against it morally. The suburbs won't be affected by this, as you know, Dan. They're, you know, another thing that's going to, you know, not – people won't hear about this. They won't think about it. They'll just blow it, you know. It'll be in the city. But I want to say the Dunkin' Donuts on Jackson and Federal right around the corner from the ULC. You know where that is, Dan?
Yeah.
That's a sketchy area. It has been forever. I wouldn't be caught dead down there. I would never ride the CTA again ever. We don't even go to the Union League Club anymore. We used to be there all the time. It was a, you know, it was a great place to hang out. They almost lost it and closed during the pandemic. Did you know that, Dan?
Yeah. I mean, it's another thing that's gone by the wayside. Yeah. Thanks for the call, Mary Kay, is the clubs in Chicago, University Club, Union League Club, Skyline Club, where I used to go, Chicago Club to a lesser extent. But that was a cool part of the tapestry in Chicago. I know. I think, oh, you know, you're hoity-toity private clubs. But
so you don't go to the Skyline Club anymore?
No, I'm done. I'm done with all of it. The way it's like these restaurants and businesses, the way they behave during COVID.
Oh, did they? Oh, yeah, they followed the vaccine mandate.
Nope.
Needed to show your papers to eat some food, did you?
I'm not doing it. By the way, to her point about, oh, this will be in the city thing, suburbs. Oh, really? Just the city? You sure about that? I wouldn't be so sure about that, for example. There were shots fired at some bar in Roselle. A woman got shot in the head over the weekend. Mm-hmm. Is Roselle a suburb? I think so. Don't be so sure. We've talked about the auto thefts that have occurred along the metro stops and the L stops in the suburbs for a couple of years now. There was a good piece, I'm blanking on the outlet now, but about sophisticated burglary rings targeting the suburbs. So, you know, you have a lot of suburbs that have lost their minds too. That we're marching with Black Lives Matter or for Black Lives Matter, that we're defunding the police and all of the other silliness over the last 2 years. And those suburbs will pay a price as well, because a lot of them don't have any better leadership than they did 2 years ago.
You've made the switch and it feels so good. You switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission: to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So, I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Continuing our discussion about the disintegration of America's great cities and suburban communities around them. Let's fold that in. Kim Glass, Olympic volleyball player, silver medalist, walking on the streets in Los Angeles the other week, middle of the day, and some homeless guy with a history of violence on the streets.
And he had some like long pipe, a metal pipe.
Yeah, he blindsided her with a 10-inch metal pipe. He cracked her in the head. He almost blinded her. She was on Fox over the weekend talking a little bit about it. You know, the whole why did this happen to me? She answered that question, and it's a particularly important answer she gives. But first, just the impact, too, because as we've talked about before, shared stories before, we focus on, of course, capital crimes. We focus on people whose lives have been taken, and that's appropriate. But that doesn't tell the whole story about lawlessness. It's not just the people that are killed. It's also the people that are hurt and survive.
Man, I'm healing. My emotions change every day. I'm always really grateful and happy that this didn't turn out as bad as it could have been. But, I'll be in the car with someone and someone will come up towards the car. I like freak out sometimes. So every day is a little bit different. I'm still processing this all.
She talked about how she views her attack, how this random act of violence could happen to her.
I feel like I'm always alert, and there's nothing I could have done to prevent this. Yeah. You know, I know everyone's out there offering me self-defense classes, and how'd you let him get close to you? I'm like, he wasn't close, and I could have never predicted this happening. And as I've been home and thinking about this, I said, God, you chose me for a reason, you know? And the reason is, one, you know, I'm hard-headed, so you knew I was going to make it. And I think, and you know that I still have work to do here. And, but also because he had other attackers, and there's been other victims around Los Angeles, and it keeps on happening. And everyone's paying attention to me because I'm an Olympian, right? But these other attackers haven't been, the other victims haven't been vindicated, right? Every time someone's being let out on the street again and again, they're doing a disservice, and they're pretty much saying that these victims' traumas were in vain. And now, like, I'm hoping that this doesn't happen to anyone else again.
Well, and it happened. The 37-year-old NASCAR driver, Bobby East, he was pumping gas. Broad daylight. 37 years old, not a care in the world, and the guy came up from behind him and stabbed him in the chest. And it happened about 40 miles outside of Los Angeles, but it keeps happening. It doesn't matter if you're an Olympic volleyball player or a NASCAR driver. These crazies don't care.
She has a question, does Kim Glass.
He was let out on probation, and he attacked someone else, and that was a misdemeanor, right? But before that, he had already assault and battered two other people, and they were all women, right? And so what does it take, you know? Like, we just keep dropping the ball, and we keep dropping the ball. You know, I look at it like this, like, I'm a professional. I was a professional athlete, right? Mm-hmm. I've been a part of teams all my life, right? And if I keep doing something wrong the entire time, I have to change something because it's not working for the team. Mm. You know, and if I'm not changing something, then I get taken out and someone else replaces me. And at this point, what's the answer? Yeah. You know, because something, everything that we're doing right now is not working.
Yeah. Well,
and there needs to be a change.
What's it going to take? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636-DA, turnkey.pro, text line. What's it going to take? A familiar story. Somebody who has a history of violence, who's out on the street to commit more violence. And Kim Glass this time was the victim. But I think she's got her finger on the matter. And I like the metaphor she uses of team.
Me too. Because if it's not working, you got to get off. You got to change players.
Yeah.
That's basically what she said.
Here's the problem. I know you immediately think, exactly, we need to change out the leadership in prosecutors' offices and mayor's offices and governor's offices in particular cities and states. Yeah. But how do you change out the voters?
That's a good question, because they're part of the team.
The voters,
they're
are the
players.
Coach.
Well,
no, they're the coach in this metaphor. They're not the players. Who switches out the voters? Hmm.
And just like with the NASCAR driver who got killed east, the person who stabbed him, police say, was a transient who was known to authorities in several run-ins with the law, dealing with mental illness, homelessness.
One response, and it's not the first lawsuit, but there's been another one filed here in Chicago. The family of Vietnam veteran Keith Cooper, who was killed in a carjacking in Mount Greenwood, back in 2021. His family has filed suit against Cook County Sheriff Tom Dart and Chief Judge Tim Evans.
Because?
Asserts the two men charged in Cooper's death were improperly allowed to leave their homes, even though as the lawsuit alleges, both men had been previously charged with carjacking and possession of a stolen vehicle and were supposedly on
electronic monitoring.
And finish it while awaiting trial.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So that we start there. If someone commits a violent crime, they should be in jail awaiting trial.
The lawsuit filed by Keith Cooper's daughter, he just lays out the facts. If you've forgotten this carjacking incident, because there's so many to keep track of, even fatal ones, just out driving his black Hyundai, running errands, and Vietnam veteran, 73-year-old Vietnam veteran, gets carjacked and killed. They didn't succeed in taking his car. They immediately attempted to flee on foot. They were captured by police a few blocks away from the attack, thanks to witnesses who identified them. At least these two are in custody, by the way, 18 and 17 at the time of the crime. 18 and 17.
They didn't even use a weapon. They stunned him by punching him in the back of the head from behind and then pushed him in the chest and that was knocked over.
Yeah, well.
Died moments later.
73 years old.
And fought a war and then he gets involved in another street war here in Chicago.
In Indiana yesterday, there was a mall shooting. Four people dead, including the shooter.
And a 12-year-old girl is one of the victims.
Real hero. Wait, 12-year-old girl was treated and released.
Oh, she was?
Yeah.
Then CBS had it wrong.
Jim Eisen, the police chief of Greenwood, Indiana, which is south of Indianapolis, explained how this horrific incident came to end.
We believe at this time investigators are still questioning the individual involved, but it appears that a good Samaritan that was armed observed the shooting in progress and shot the shooter.
And they said there would have been dozens of other shooting victims had that Good Samaritan not acted right away. Because he walked into a food court and just started indiscriminately spraying bullets.
Expect this story to not get a lot of coverage because you have two things. Well, you have the absence of one thing and the presence of another. You have the absence of a sport rifle. A long gun was used. And you, so I assume they mean a shotgun. And you have a good Samaritan who, the proverbial good guy with a gun who stopped the massacre.
He was armed, yeah, with a rifle, multiple magazines.
Not the whole story. Not the whole story when it comes to these mass shootings. And we'll get to that next hour, what I think the whole story is. But nonetheless, very pragmatic, what you have to be prepared to do as these streets have been turned over to predators, defend yourself. Steve and Roselle, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Yeah, Dan, you're right. How do you change out the voters? A lot of people say, when are people going to wake up? Well, I think they are awake, and the reason is that some of these politicians use as their core base the criminal element. So, you know, Jesse Jackson going to jail every Christmas and telling people when they get out to register to vote, you know, before long that adds up to a large number of votes.
Yeah, how about gangbangers who work the precincts for aldermen and mayors? The intersection between street gangs and politics in Chicago has a long history. I know Chicago. I don't know other cities as well, but I certainly wouldn't be surprised to learn that some other cities have similar histories. Absolutely. Chris on the Dan Ryan.
I think you said the same thing, Dan. You pretty much summed it up for me. The Good Samaritan did a good job. But again, it will not get any news because it doesn't play into their lovely storyline that they want to sell over and over again. But, you know, I will be honest with you. You know, this weekend, me and my wife, we went bought a handgun. And my wife is a first-time handgun owner, and I've owned guns all my life. So it's kind of a sad situation when I'm telling my wife that, you know, unfortunately, you know, unless we move, we have to stay here for a while. You know, we have to defend ourselves because no one's going to come to our rescue. That kind of sucks. So,
thanks for the call, Chris.
Oh, wow.
22-year-old, the Good Samaritan that stopped the shooting at the mall in Greenwood, Indiana. 22-year-old used a handgun.
And he had a legal gun permit and is fully cooperating with police.
Did you ever see that movie, The Purge, from, I don't know, about 10 years ago? Ethan Hawke and
yes.
Lena Headey. You did see it?
I remember Ethan Hawke in The Purge.
The premise, and it was like a mediocre, it was sort of an interesting concept that was done not great. But anyway, the premise of the movie is one night a year for 12 hours in 2022 America. It took place in 2022 America. For 12 hours, one night a year, nothing is illegal.
Right. People wear like clown masks. They do whatever they want. It's a frightening film.
the premise is unemployment is at 1% and violent crime is almost non-existent because one night a year you have this purge and it cleanses. You know, you release all of the demons. Right. I don't buy the premise of the movie. It's just sort of an interesting dystopian take. But it seems like that's what we've decided to do
every
day of the year in big city America. John in Mattoon, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi there. You know, I sit back and I look at this situation, Uvalde, and the police officers involved. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I got to take the side of these guys are worried about losing their families, losing their careers, losing everything they have. By going in and doing the right thing. When are we going to start waking up? Well, I think we are woke up. But let's understand what happened there to talk about systemic failures. Let's start with the systemic failure of the system, not of the police officers. And that's all I have to say.
Thanks for the call, John. Appreciate it. We'll talk about Uvalde at the top of the 6 o'clock hour. Larry and Bartlett.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. Thanks for taking my call. I would be willing to bet you a dollar against a donut that there were probably gun-free zones, no guns allowed, decals on the doors entering that mall. And undoubtedly, at least in my mind, some wacko politician in that area is going to say he violated the law. He should be tried and convicted of violating the gun-free zone law.
No, he's not.
That's my thought.
Thanks
no,
for the
I mean, I, he's not. Police have said that he had a legal gun permit. They are not going to charge him, and he's fully cooperating with police, and they're calling him a good Samaritan. So I do not think a politician is going to come forward demanding that he get charged with something.
Probably not, but Larry's from Bartlett's point is well taken nonetheless. You can have a right to carry permit, but there it doesn't mean you get to right. You have the right to carry everywhere. This is the
right. If it happened in Chicago, maybe, but it
no. This is people have private property rights, and so they can say, "Yeah, you have a right to carry, but you don't have a right to carry on my property. You're not allowed on my property with a gun." And in malls that have stores that are part of big corporations, yeah, even in Indiana, you'll routinely see no guns.
Right, I see those. So even if there's a sign at your church and somebody had a concealed carry.
Yeah, you can.
And a bad guy came in and was shooting people, shooting prisoners, and you shoot the bad guy because they had that little sign with the circle on it, no gun, you could get charged.
Technically, it's possible. It's unlikely because obviously he saved lives. We get that. But that's the silliness of it all, isn't it? And that's Larry's point.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. The report by Texas lawmakers on the police response at Uvalde has been filed, and it reflects basically what we've seen. Although 376 officers from local, state, and federal agencies rushed to the shooting at Robb Elementary, none took command of the chaotic scene, effectively leaving the inexperienced local school district police department to lead the response. The 77-page report concluded the officers, quote, failed to prioritize saving the lives of innocent victims over their own safety, end quote.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
I'll cede my time on this in terms of making an assessment of their response to a retired Jacksonville SWAT officer, Jared Reston, who now trains SWAT officers around the country.
Good.
He was interviewed by a local network affiliate down there and described what he saw, what was done versus what should have done. But he makes some interesting points about police.
They didn't do what they were supposed to do. They didn't do what they signed up to do. They didn't do it. I think that they pushed initially. They got kind of shot off the doorway by the suspect, and they acted cowardice and ran. And then from that point on, they even had, like, chiefs of police, like their chief telling them, hold on, it's a barricade, which... Yes, it's true. He is. It's not actively going on right now, but there are people bleeding inside that room, and you have to get in there to save their lives, right? I mean, they're bleeding out, so their life is leaving their body. So you're on that time schedule where you got to push, and they didn't push. They they stayed safe. And it, you know, it's sad that they did that, but you know, not everybody's created the same, and it took, you know, some guys with probably more training and more experience of doing stuff to push in there and actually go do the job. There's parts in the video with like a guy goes to the hand sanitizer and like washes his hands because he's just in code black. He is stressed way above his limits and he doesn't know what the heck's going on. And I bet you could probably ask him and he doesn't ever remember doing that.
It's interesting, the code black comment.
They did what they did. And you can't, there is no reassurance that it will never happen again, because it's just, it's sometimes it's just a roll of the dice who shows up there that day, because their training didn't tell them to run away. That's the truth.
So their training didn't tell them to run away. They were there, but they didn't do anything. And who finally took charge was a Border Patrol agent who's like, we're going in. And I mean, and it started from the beginning when the gunman was running into the school and the two officers had him, and they asked for permission first before, because they could have shot him and killed him right there before he even entered the darn building. But they asked for permission? I mean, what kind of training is that?
We also find that, according to the report, the gunman, man responsible for the 21 deaths.
We don't even know his name.
Never fired a gun before.
Never?
That's the conclusion. So here's the code black thing is interesting. You know, it's, I guess it's to some extent it's a reminder. Not all cops are created equally. Not all teachers are created equally. Not everybody in any profession is created equally. You have people that are differently skilled, no matter how much training. And that includes sort of what SWAT officer Rustin was talking about, those who get beyond their capacity for response in a crisis.
But that officer using the hand sanitizer enraged the nation.
Yeah, I understand. But
it looks so
everybody gets it.
Casual.
And now listen to what Rustin's saying if you want to try and understand it.
What about the fist bump? Do you see that video? Like, hey, how you doing? What? And you can hear gunshots going up. The shooter was probably like, why is nobody coming in here to take me down? 77 minutes? Come on, people.
Related story. Police involved shooting in Minneapolis. Protests going on in Minneapolis. A man named Tekel Sundberg was shot and killed by police after he opened fire in the apartment building in which he lived and almost killed his next door neighbor and then shot at police when they arrived on the scene. But there's a protest going on in Minneapolis. Arabella Yarborough was the woman who was almost killed by Sundberg when he opened fire in his apartment building, and the bullets went through the wall and almost killed Yarborough and her kids. So she showed up to this Black Lives Matter, We Hate Police rally to put in a word in about Sundberg as they're lionizing him and mourning him and suggesting that this was excessive force.
There's bullet, there was casings in the hallway. The shot went through my door to the pillar to the kitchen. I was cooking food for my kids. They shouldn't know. It doesn't matter. He shouldn't have been dead. Y'all should have came and helped him when he was alive.
Yarborough talking to the press.
That man was armed. George Floyd was not armed. Breonna Taylor was not armed. Amir Lockett, he was armed. And he had his own guns, but they came into his home while he's licensed to carry and killed him. He did not shoot fire. This man intentionally tried to kill us.
Attorney for the Sundberg family.
We can feel terribly for this woman, but also remember that Tekle should be here with us, and he should be alive, and we can ask the Minneapolis Police Department to do better.
The protest leader responding to Miss Yarborough's criticisms.
We're not condoning any behavior whatsoever. We're not. If he was shooting, doing something, or putting people in harm's way. We're not condoning that at all, but we're just saying we want the same treatment for us as they give white people.
Really? Could you give us an instance there where there was a white person who opened fire in his apartment building, almost killing his next-door neighbor and or her kids, and then opened fire on police when they arrived on scene and was given a key to the city? Is that what you think happens? So I put these two side by side, the juxtaposition of the Minneapolis and the Uvalde, sort of what you heard from our friend from Mattoon, the former police officer, last hour about, understanding the complicated calculus now police are going through when they roll up onto a scene where there is a active shooter situation. This is not to in any way justify the failure to respond by Uvalde police and all of those various agencies represented by officers on that day at Robb Elementary, not at all. Complete agreement with what that SWAT officer, Jared Rustin, had to say in his assessment. But it is to address sort of the larger cultural issues that we have as we talk about being serious about providing for the public safety. Talk about it, because there are clearly people like the guy with the blowhorn giving a very stylized version of the events that led to Tekel Sundberg's death. There are people who are not serious about it. They're not. Maybe they think they are, but they just aren't on the merits. And this has to be addressed. Something else, too, I wanted to get to about mass shootings. Uvalde, the mall yesterday, Highland Park. This piece by Catherine D. over at Contra, the Contra Substack. Mass shootings and the world liberalism made. She criticizes, and I agree with her, the fewer guns or more guns debate. That's the sum total of our conversation. Fewer guns, more guns, fund mental illness, or fund treatment for mental illness. In the last decade between Sandy Hook and the recent shooting in Uvalde, we seem to have learned nothing. We are as mystified today as we were then, which is why, sadly, more Uvaldes are likely to come unless we learn to reckon with reality and think beyond trite talking points. It's not the prevalence of guns. There have always been guns. Nor is it the dearth of guns. Paradoxically, either restricting access to firearms or making sure more teachers have them might do some good, but neither addresses the real reason for taking those steps in the first place. What we have in America is a nihilism problem, and in the West, not just America, but it's particularly pronounced here. My parenthetical remark. We have a nihilism problem. And in the many, many mass shootings we've covered over the years in this show, this has been raised by me a number of times. I think Ms. D presents it in a compelling fashion. And she also has done real interesting research on some of these mass shooters. She interviewed people about the Sandy Hook shooter. And she's got a little bit of the history summarized in her piece about these mass shooters. It's, the point, which I've made many, many times, it's a lot more complicated than they're just crazy. A lot more complicated. She writes, when she says we have a nihilism problem, by we, I mean the huge swaths of American society consumed by hopelessness, rage, and fear reflected in our politics, tribalism, social media, and even language. Many of us seem incapable of containing our furls, even as we are unsure what we're raging against. Our furies, I should say. Unfurling our furies. Violence begets violence. We all have become desensitized to the sound and fury of riots from Washington to Waukesha. In their swirl of confusion, nothing has meaning. Meaning is elusive. Nihilism, the rejection of the possibility of meaning, is the water in which we swim and the darkness that has enveloped our way of life in ways we haven't even begun to comprehend. The mass shooter has given up on stripping away artifices and facades to get to real meaning. The mass shooter says finding meaning is futile. Meaning no longer exists. Maybe it did once, but it doesn't anymore. The Columbine shooters, as well as the Sandy Hook shooter, were inspired by Nietzsche, the cult of Charles Manson. The Sandy Hook shooter by antinatalist Gary Emmendem. For other shooters, the turn is more intuitive or personal or traumatic, coming from within as an all-enveloping, crushing existential angst that leaves them unable to see the purpose in life. That's the Colorado movie theater shooting. The Colorado shooter, that movie?
In Aurora, Colorado.
Lest you forget, he was a graduate student in neuroscience.
Wow.
Graduate student
in
neuroscience.
Can't be done to get in that program.
Who seemed fed up with ideas. He felt trapped in a great emptiness, she writes. The Sandy Hook shooter, he had a YouTube channel under the name Cultural Philistine. The videos painted a picture not of a deranged killer or a sadist, but a lucid young man with a rich, complicated intellectual life. In these videos, all of which featured a black screen and a scratchy voiceover, the Sandy Hook shooter laid out his philosophy. The most unsettling thing is the cogency with which the shooter presented his views.
I never heard of those before.
A blogger named Blithering Genius actually analyzed the videos in a piece called The Ghost of the Sandy Hook Shooter. He uses the name, I won't. In his essay, this blogger, Blithering Genius, describes the Sandy Hook Shooter's philosophy as the rejection of culture. He thought of culture as delusion and disease. The blogger hypothesizes that the Sandy Hook shooter targeted schools because that is where, in his thinking, our culture, our values are transmitted. More to the point, he killed children because they represent the propagation of life. He couldn't have viewed murder as harmful, at least not philosophically, writes this blogger. In his worldview, death was salvation and enlightenment. To call this bone-chilling would be an understatement, writes Catherine D. So the Sandy Hook shooter was actually bookish and intellectually developed beyond his 20 years. So you want to holster the everybody's crazy? You need to if you want to be serious about this. She gives another example. Consider the guy who killed two students at Aztec High School in New Mexico before killing himself. He was widely described in reports as the alt-right shooter. She writes, it's true over time his posts acquired a racist and misogynist hue, but that intolerance is not the thread that courses through his many writings. It's a belief that life is a problem imposed on human beings by a hateful God and must be overcome. In an early forum post, he wrote, all humans should be entitled to an instant painful death. Jack Kevorkian is a hero. He thought of himself as more rational, peaceful, and less loony, because he thought of himself as seeing the lie of everyday existence. So it was with another guy, shooter, who killed three of his coworkers at a grocery store in 2017 and, quote, never seemed to understand the purpose of life, unquote. She goes through the shooter who killed six and injured Gabby Giffords.
Well, yes, not saying his name.
They rejected civilization as artificial. Morality, justice, other values are products of civilization. So they're arbitrary and meaningless. The solution? Eliminate humanity. Overseas, not just an American thing, but decidedly one. The killer who killed one and wounded 19 in 2006 in Montreal believed whole society need to be eradicated. The whole of society. A person who killed eight in a high school in a little north of Helsinki, Finland, called for the death of the entire human race. Going back to Catherine D., she writes, we imagine these killers have nothing to do with everyone else. that they are like a leper colony set apart from the rest of us. And every so often, one escapes and spreads his disease. We want to believe that because it makes us feel good, but the reality is that the smudge of nihilism's fingerprints stains all things everywhere. It's in the half-joking, half-serious proclamations of millennials who say they don't want children because of the climate. It's in the ubiquity of even darker humor, the kind that was popularized by 4chan in the mid-2010s and captured the public imagination, the sort of thing that can only be funny if life has lost any value. It's in the commingling of our leisure and anesthesia. We drink to escape. We exercise until we can't feel anything. We propel ourselves into fantasy lives with fandom, cosplay. It's even paradoxically in our insistence on living in the moment. Nothing matters, so we might as well be happy with where we are. The darker side of YOLO is how it forecloses on the possibility that our lives matter in any grander sense, that we can be part of a tradition that started long before we were born and will extend for ages after we die. Most of us can distract ourselves from the towering emptiness of right now. We can doom scroll Twitter or TikTok and binge whatever Netflix tells us to watch, and we can do it all over again tomorrow. All of us, not just the shooters, are plagued by a crisis of meaning. However, despite the feeling that the world may not be right, most of us have the psychological cognitive equipment to forge ahead, to make friends, graduate from school, build a career, build a family. Because even though there are bad things, we have an obligation to ourselves and to the world to create good things. But shooters don't know how to do any of that. And it was true of the Sandy Hook shooter, and it was true of the Uvalde shooter, who are incapable of sublimating their darkest impulses. She concludes her piece, which I'll tweet out because you should read it and share it. The debate over more guns or fewer guns completely misses the horrifying heart of the matter. The world built by modern liberalism, which took for its telos the maximization of individual autonomy and thus guaranteed total alienation, breeds the nihilism behind these shootings. Ultimately, these killers could not cope the way the rest of us do every day with the crushing weight of the existential angst that is the promise of liberalism. Even the more thoughtful takes on fatherlessness and mental illness are still only addressing the symptoms of the disease. Until we see this, the ground of the problem, we will be no closer to answers, let alone solutions for these 21st century horrors. What is the purpose of life? Why don't you guys start by getting some sort of consensus answer to that question? What is the purpose of life? And, you know, and do that with your kids, particularly if you have a kid that's struggling. So they reject this rejection of civilization that seems to be a common thread among all of these mass murderers. Frank in Arlington Heights, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning. Very interesting stuff you're just talking about. Three solutions in my mind. Number one, I think people need to read Kierkegaard a little more. It's about a leap of faith. We really do. Or St. Thomas Aquinas, one of those two. And then the other two is these are a little more, less serious. We need more shows. This is more for like the cop response in Uvalde. We need more TV shows today like T.J. Hooker. Wasn't that a great show?
Yeah, sure.
I mean, you know, T.J. Hooker out there just...
sliding over the hood of his squad car.
Sliding over the hood.
More of a Charlie's Angels running. Girl.
Having witty banter with Heather Locklear. Yeah.
Yeah, William Shatner just running straight out. I mean, he's just going straight out in the opening there. We need more inspiration like that, I guess. And the last thing is I was going to say is, you know, we also got to think positively here, like in that movie Life of Brian. Always look at the bright side of the world. We have some pretty rough neighborhoods in our country, but, you know, ancient Rome, they had pretty rough neighborhoods too. You went in there, you could get killed. But you could also wind up just walking down the street and getting their little poop pots and urine pots thrown down at you.
It can always be worse.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. It's good perspective.
Have a good day.
Thanks for the call, Frank. Tom in Galesburg.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Thanks for taking the call. I got a twin brother that spent a career in law enforcement in San Francisco, and he shared an interesting perspective on a recent podcast. He drew a parallel between doctors and physicians that are essentially allowed to use both their training and their experience when they're dealing with the unknown. to perform diagnosis and then actually execute something. And in that instance, there isn't necessarily a rigid expectation that the outcomes are guaranteed. In contrast to that, law enforcement goes through an extraordinary amount of training and now is, by law, is being disallowed to deploy its experience. And then we wonder why we're getting the results that we're getting. It ties out to your earlier conversation about the suicides of police officers. Well, they represent the spear, the tip of the spear of civility in this country. We now have a populace that expects perfection here on earth, which is a correlation of the fact that at the same time they're purging religiosity from our culture, and they're filling that void with government. So given that human nature does not change, it's about time the American people got their head out of their collective rear end and allowed human nature to be controlled. Law enforcement is the tip of the spear. It's deeply disturbing that men and women find themselves accepting the responsibilities to be the tip of the spear on behalf of civility and then not being allowed to do their job.
Thanks for the call, Tom. Appreciate it.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Would be remiss if we didn't congratulate Noah Schultz, White Sox first-round pick in the MLB draft. Noah Schultz from Oswego East.
Oh, a local.
Yeah, he's going to Vandy, I believe. And then,
Cameron Smith, come on.
Cameron Smith is a golfer.
Right. Gotta congratulate him on his win. And his hairdo.
Okay. Well,
you were talking about athletes, so I said, that's good.
Oh, I see. Well,
yeah.
Okay.
Because you tweeted something out about Cameron Smith, and some fancy superstar retweeted your tweet.
Well, yeah, David Spade retweeted my tweet. Because,
oh, just David Spade.
Because I tweeted out a picture of Joe Dirt and Cameron Cam Smith side by side and said that Joe Dirt can really putt. It's clutch. I mean, he really can. And Spade said, and Spade retweeted saying, we did it.
You know, that's good.
It was funny. It was good.
Wow. Look at you. Chance the Rapper and David Spade.
Yeah. Right. I'm really getting the attention of the A-listers in Hollywood.
But if you grow that party in the back a little longer,
I could
have that hairdo too.
Also, congratulations to Owen Murphy. Wanted to get him in, too, because he's another local that was drafted by the Braves. And he's Notre Dame? No, wait, no. He was going to Notre Dame, right? Yeah. And he's from Riverside Brookfield. All right, I got the high sign from Mike.
Well, that's Mike's stomping ground, Riverside.
Oh, I understand. So, congratulations.
It's his daughter's high school. That's a big deal.
Noah Schultz has a little Chris Sale in him, from what I've seen. I like it. So we'll see there. If only sports hadn't become so hyper-politicized, including Major League Baseball, that I could actually follow it, pay attention to it, and enjoy it. But alas.
I still can't believe you gave up your White Sox tickets.
Alas, it's not. It's just not
Skyline
it anymore.
Skyline Club, White Sox tickets.
Dropping out of society.
Basically.
Best I can for all kinds of good reasons. For example, the nominees for NCAA Woman of the Year are in.
And?
Well, the nominees are in, and one of the nominees is?
Clownfish,
yeah.
Yeah, Leah Thomas.
Leah Thomas has been nominated by the University of Pennsylvania, by the college.
Right, not by her teammates.
No.
Or her coaches, right? Wasn't this the higher-ups, the administrators?
Well, yeah, or like not by, you know, some advocacy group. No. University of Pennsylvania nominating Leah Thomas for Woman of the Year. Ivy League school nominating a man pretending to be a woman, so he can succeed in swimming to be NCAA Woman of the Year. That's where we're at.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Here's where we're at. Matt Keener writing over at The Federalist. Stumbling across the Protect Trans Youth booth in my small town. He lives in Medina, Ohio. You know, enjoying the 4th with his family, milling about the local festival. I was stunned and wanted to ask the people at the booth what they mean by that when they say it. Do they even know what do they mean by protect trans youth? Because those were the signs being passed out at the 4th of July festival in Medina, Ohio. Protect trans youth. Keena writes, protect trans youth. What is a trans youth exactly? Are you for puberty blockers for adolescents and teens? Are you for castrating children having top or bottom surgeries? As I was standing there thinking about some of these questions, I heard a friend I haven't seen since the pandemic who tapped my shoulder from the booth she was working at as I stared in a bit of disbelief. I'm sorry, I said after we exchanged pleasantries. I'm sort of shocked by the protect trans youth signs. Yeah, she said. They were kind of worried about it. They wanted to be sure there were enough police.
Oh.
For the marauding mobs that are looking to violate trans youth. Right. Uh-huh. An organization called Out Support, based out of Ohio, boasted its plans for the day. A limited supply of hate has no home here. And support trans youth signs, sort of a hate has no home here 2.0, will be available for a donation of any amount. Also, stop by the Pizza Palooza for your favorite rainbow bling. It mentioned that the local library would offer a monthly LGBTQIA plus teen craft club. From schools to libraries to the local farmers market, we appear to have gone all in on the idea that the trans movement is something we should mix well and often with our kids. The leap we've made since I went to high school in the late 90s and early 2000s, when it seemed easy to conclude someone like Matt Shepard in no way deserved to die for what was ostensibly a sexual preference, although actually that case was a drug deal gone bad, but you know the truth is the first casualty with the propagandists. But his point, the leap we've made since I went to high school in the late 90s and early 2000s, to present day, force-feeding children gay and trans propaganda 20 years later in elementary schools is extraplanetary. It really is. And he speaks about these two representatives of our nation overseas. Did you see this picture? America's representatives at the French ambassador's residence this week.
Oh yeah, somebody tweeted that out, and what has American military become?
the dude Rachel Levin, who's number two at HHS, and that other dude Sam Britton.
Who's Sam Britton?
He just was confirmed as like the director of nuclear waste management in the Department of Energy. We've talked about him before. This guy,
I've never seen him before. That
Oh yeah.
Oh, my.
It's something to behold. Levin openly advocates for puberty blockers, chemical castration, and physical alterations to minors.
And don't forget what Levin did. He yanked his mother out of a nursing home in Pennsylvania when he was with the health department there and saved her life while others died. Because he knew that that was the highest risk group and the highest risk setting. Very selfish of him. I mean, it's his mother, but still, give me a break.
But as for the kids, again, I don't want to just so casually say this without making sure the implications are registering. Puberty blockers, chemical castration, and physical alterations to minors.
Without parental consent?
Sam Britton, the other dude there, these two bosom buddies over at the French ambassador's house. He's an apologist for pedophiles.
What?
I'm not kidding. And it's not even a close call. Which is understandable because we've all given in over at the Protect Trans Youth booth to Love is Love. Okay.
Mark Kirk, love who you love.
That's right. Life is all about who you love and who loves you back. Well, erase all the lines, and how do you redraw them for sexual predators? You don't. And at some point, we won't.
Do you think that's going to become legal someday?
That's the road we're on. I mean, this is where we're at. Leah Thomas is a nominee for Woman of the Year a nomination by an Ivy League college, university.
And up to two female athletes can be nominated from each school, and a total of 577 nominees.
And these
are
two,
in the running for this.
And these two ghouls in the business of promoting the castration, chemical castration of minors and the sexual exploitation of minors are senior level government officials in D.C. And you think normalizing pedophilia is science fiction stuff? I don't think so.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Guy in Glendale Heights.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. How you doing?
Good.
Good. I just want to bring some awareness. Me and my boys, we have stumbled across a flyer for a transgender brunch in Lake in the Hills. It's 5:30 this Saturday at an Uprising buffet and eatery, and we have no problem with that. But when we continue to read the flyer, it says special price for 13 and under. So me and my boys are just trying to bring awareness to everybody about this event, and we've pretty much done that. I think we're on WGN. But yeah, it's got to stop. The sexualizing children is just wrong. And thank you for letting me.
Are you going to the event, Guy?
Oh, yeah.
Protesting outside of it, or are you going to try to get in?
Well, we're doing a special protest. We're not going to be there to yell or scream, or we're just going to stand outside with a nice silent protest just to bring awareness to the community. That's about it.
Thanks for the call, Guy.
Guy and his guys, huh?
Tony in Downers Grove.
He's a posse.
All right, so Dad, this is nothing new. It's you've talked about it. It's like, well, what's the harm with gay marriage? I mean, because most people are like, there's no harm here, right? Harm to society.
Right.
But then you break it down. Now, where does it move? Now we're into transgenders. It's like, let them celebrate. Let them be themselves. Jamie Lee Curtis comes out and celebrates her 25-year-old daughter or whatever being trans. And so we're not peeling back the layers. It's let them be themselves, but we're not talking about the real issues. And where is the media when Leah Thomas gets nominated for this? It's like ho-hum. Yet, if you really talk to people on the street, it's like, what the hell's going on? But it's the minority with the majority voice.
Yes.
And then how do you overcome that? And then how do you overcome the manipulated science that's being thrown out there to where genitalia is not associated with gender any longer because it's a scientific fact that it's separate. It's two separate issues. I don't know how to get past this. So,
well, I mean, thanks for calling. You get past lying by telling the truth. That's how you get past it. And by challenging other people to say what they know to be true, be courageous enough. There's no other way. Biological male who's doing a 30-year sentence for manslaughter identifies as a female, so of course he was in a female prison in New Jersey, and he impregnated two fellow prisoners. So now he's being moved out of that women's prison. Why?
Because he's not a woman.
Well, that's not. Well, how did he not become a woman? That's what they said. He was a woman. That's why he said he's a woman. So they said he's a woman. That's why he's in a women's prison. Just because he impregnated two women, why would he move him? Is that an admission that you're out of your mind? Is that an admission that this is a politically driven fraud? Come on. And this is how you have to challenge people. I mean, come on. The City Club of Chicago. Friend of mine sent me this, fill out your personal info demos to, I guess, just
membership.
Yeah, for your membership, right?
Yeah. What are the questions that they ask?
My demographics, ethnicity, gender, orientation options, asexual, bisexual, hetero, homo, lesbian, LGBTQIA+, pansexual, queer, I choose not to identify.
Well, they don't have enough on there. There's 73 different sexes.
Yeah.
No.
That's insufficient for you? Yeah. You're upset.
They need to have the entire list on there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Binary, non-binary.
Well, no. That was orientation. Options.
Well, yeah.
Gender.
Oh, sorry. Excuse me.
Female, male, trans, female, trans, male, non-binary, agender, gender queer. I choose not to identify. You know, those drop boxes can only drop down so far.
Okay, yeah.
So, you know.
They left out about 60 other options.
City Club of Chicago, where all of the deep thinkers, the civic and community panjandrums meet to talk big ideas over your family style lunch at Maggiano's. This is farcical. Farcical. It makes the Babylon Bee's job impossible.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Remember when the big guy was in the running for the nomination for president back in the 2019-2020 cycle? During debates with his many colleagues, including his future VP, a lot of tough talk on Saudi Arabia and what President Trump was failing to do in disciplining the royal family after the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. This was the big guy back then.
And I would make it very clear, we were not going to, in fact, sell more weapons to them. We were going to, in fact, make them pay the price and make them, in fact, the pariah that they are. There's very little social redeeming value in the present government in Saudi Arabia. And I would also, as pointed out, I would end the subsidies that we have, end the sale of material to the Saudis, who they're going in and murdering children and they're murdering innocent people. And so they have to be held accountable.
Fast forward to Friday, and it's all fist bumps.
Oh, yeah, because he didn't want to get the handshake moment caught on camera for the well, because he wanted to keep it quick. You know, it was all about COVID. He might get the vid, man.
Yeah, well, that didn't go unnoticed, even by the Amazon Post. They are all upset. Joe Biden, worse than a handshake, it shows a sort of a familiarity and acceptance. They're very upset with their guy about that moment. Biden also entertained a question about Jamal Khashoggi's wife's reaction to his receiving of MBS. This is what he said.
We just heard from Jamal Khashoggi's wife, who said, after this visit, the blood of MBS's next victim is on your hands. What do you say to Mrs. Khashoggi?
I'm sorry she feels that way. I was straightforward back then. I was straightforward today.
Yeah, and there's some dispute about how straightforward he was at his meeting with MBS in terms of bringing up Khashoggi's murder straight away and this tough talk that he allegedly offered MBS. Some question about that, because the statement from the Saudis was MBS pushed back on the issue of Khashoggi by saying, well, Biden's a hypocrite. Why doesn't he want to talk about the Israelis killing of that Al Jazeera journalist? For more on this and a few other geopolitical matters, pleased to be joined again by Cliff May, the president of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies and foreign affairs columnist for The Washington Times. Cliff, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Dan, Amy, good to be with you guys.
So bottom line, are we getting the oil or not?
We were not promised by the Saudi crown prince that there would be additional oil flowing. That mission was not accomplished on this trip.
So, but Biden thinks by making the earth cleaner by pumping oil in other countries than having it shipped to the United States. So he thinks it's making the earth cleaner to do this? Or why is he begging for more oil?
We have an energy policy right now, I'm afraid, under this administration that is absolutely incoherent. The president came into office and he shut down the Keystone XL pipeline from Canada, and he gave his blessing to the Nord Stream pipeline coming from Russia to Germany. So he was making us and the Europeans more dependent on Putin at a rather bad time. Though Putin read that, and I think that was one of the many things that encouraged him to do what he has been doing ever since. The idea that we can anytime soon transition, as they say, to wind and sun is just nonsense. We need oil. Now, natural gas is the other thing. Natural gas is, you could, if you want to reduce emissions, the way to do it is to pump a lot of natural gas and substitute natural gas for coal, because coal is much dirtier, much dirtier than natural gas. Instead, what we have now are the Chinese building coal plants one after the other after the other. And the idea that all this will be fixed if you just get your neighbor and you to go out and buy a Tesla. They're very pretty cars. They're wonderful computers. They're built out of petroleum materials. They run on electricity. That electricity may come from a coal plant. So this is just an unbelievably bad energy policy. And energy policy is national security policy at a certain level. So going to the Saudis and doing that and keeping our oil in the ground, keeping our natural gas in the ground, is not good from a national security perspective, from an energy stability and security perspective. None of it really makes sense. And the Saudis, look, the Saudis have some ability to increase, and they still could do so, but they weren't going to give him that promise. They can't increase probably enough. The other reason they're probably not is the Saudis are very smart in these things. They're looking ahead and they say, good possibility we could have a big recession in the U.S. and in the world. If that's the case, the price of gas will come down, because during a recession, there's less energy burned for less economic activity. If that happens, we don't want to be pumping more gas as the price of gas comes down. So we'll wait and see. We don't owe any favors.
It's remarkable that the Biden administration is essentially to the left of an avowed socialist like AMLO, President López Obrador in Mexico. In Mexico, gas is about a dollar a gallon cheaper than in the United States. The average price, it's about, I don't know, about almost $3 cheaper than California in Mexico. We've decided that it was necessary for us to allow Americans who live close to the border to go and get their gasoline on the Mexican side at lower prices, López Obrador told Biden. And right now, a lot of drivers, a lot of Americans are going to Mexico to get their gasoline. Mexico bought a refinery in Houston for $600 million. It's building a brand new one in the Mexican state of Tabasco for $8 billion. Another $3 billion is slated to modernize six other Mexican refineries. While we haven't built a new refinery in this country in 45 years, it's just stunning that we're getting lectured by a Mexican government, a country that nationalized its oil industry 70 years ago. We're getting lectured about how to invest and provide energy for the world's biggest economy from a socialist in Mexico.
Well, that's right. He has nationalized the significant amounts of oil that they have in Mexico. He's trying to do as much as he can with it. He does not believe that the most important thing he needs to do now is get Mexico or America or the world off fossil fuels. There are those who do. It's a radical environmental notion, because we do not have a substitute for fossil fuels, except of course nuclear energy, which the radical environmental left also is opposed to, even though there are no emissions from nuclear energy. It's as clean as anything we have. It's actually a very good idea at this point. You can produce electricity, but we're not doing that either. It's very expensive to build a nuclear power plant in this country. Is why? Because of all the restrictions and regulations. The very, very far left wants us all to use less energy. That means a very different lifestyle for us. But I'd also point out that they want that for the rest of the world. I lived in Africa for a number of years. Let me tell you, if you won't let a farmer in Africa afford gas for his tractor, if you won't let him afford gas for his truck so he can take his goods to market, you are saying, I want these people to be poor, because I think that's better for the environment.
Well, that's
and they will be very poor without those.
We're seeing that play out in the Netherlands right now.
Yes, you're right.
And
we're seeing it play out in Sri Lanka as well.
In Sri Lanka. And I mean, this is economic suicide by the West. The European Union is considering rationing gas across the bloc in the hopes of fighting expected shortages this winter, with the public being told to expect a tripling of prices there.
It's crazy. They in Germany, of course, they shut down clean, perfectly good, very expensive nuclear plants. They became very dependent upon Russian oil and gas and coal to some extent. I remember having this discussion with German, very senior German diplomats a couple of years ago. And it's, no, you're wrong, Cliff. We're not becoming dependent on Putin. He's becoming dependent on us. He needs our money more than we need his gas, you see. And I said, I doubt it. I actually doubt it, because he can make his people suffer, and he doesn't lose midterm elections because of it. And you can't. This is not a coherent political or policy approach to everything that's going on with Russia, which is doing terrible war crimes in Ukraine, trying to wipe the nation off the map. In regard to China, which has, they hear John Kerry come in as the envoy and say, we have to work together on climate change, and they laugh at him. And meanwhile, they're looking at to see, maybe we want to do to Taiwan what Putin is doing to Ukraine.
Speaking of Ukraine, Indiana Representative Victoria Spartz, Republican, who's from Ukraine, was supportive of aiding Ukraine from the outset, right after the invasion, but now is being publicly critical of Zelensky and top aides, raising questions about corruption, also saying in an interview with Ukrainian media outlet, you are not preparing for war. You even act like you don't have a war. You do not understand you have the biggest war after the Second World War. Pulling back the curtain as to some of the problems that exist perhaps in Ukraine, and calling into question maybe the unabashed, enthusiastic blank check writing by both parties in D.C.
Look, my view on this is the following. If you're going to spend money, and we should, I think we want to help Zelensky and help the Ukrainian people not get wiped off the map and conquered and colonized by Putin. I think that has huge ramifications for the future and other parts of the world, and for in all sorts of ways. We can talk about it, this is not incidental what's going on there. It's hugely consequential if Putin wins, and if a nation looking to the West, a nation that wants to join NATO, that wants to join the EU, if it's wiped off the map, that's hugely consequential. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't have discipline about the spending and know very well where it's going. You can pour a lot of money in on a project. This, we've done this in many different realms, and not have it get the results you want. So all that's fine, but I am not one to say, oh, it just doesn't matter if Putin wins and we and the West lose,
okay,
in this battle over Ukraine.
Yeah, fine. And I think Victoria Spartz would say the same thing, but now okay. Address what she's raising.
So this is not a new thing to do. That is to say, let's have inspector generals. Let's make sure we know where the money is going. We know how it's being spent. If we need to send people, we should always watch how our money is being spent, so it's not wasted. And we shouldn't have, Ukraine is it's not paradise. It's when we saved South Korea from being swallowed up by the Kim dynasty, backed by China and Russia, it wasn't a wonderful, free, democratic place. It is years later, of course, with all those things, but it took a very, very long time. And this is something we don't seem to understand, that when we when we go to war, and if we decide for our own reasons, mainly, not altruism, that we're going to keep a country out of the hands of our enemies, that we're going to save it from a terrible fate, we have to stay and finish the job. World War II ended a long time ago, but we still have troops in Germany. We still have troops in Italy. My son's there, by the way. We have troops after the Korean War 70 years later in Korea. We have troops in Japan. These are not easy things to do. And part of the problem is we think, oh, we should be able to do this in 2 or 3 years, and then we can just bug out, and I'm sure these people will be just fine on their own. That's not the case.
Well, yeah, we have a military presence around the world, but in terms of Ukraine, how long do you think that this is going to last?
Look, this is very hard to say. I'm not going to tell you that we know who's going to win, even with all that's going on. Putin does not care how many people how many of his troops he kills in order to win. There are three possibilities, right? That one is lovely if Zelensky can push the Russians out, at least out of everywhere. He's not Crimea. That's not going to happen. Another possibility is that he gets overtaken and there's no such thing as Ukraine 10 years from now. Another possibility, and this is not an unlikely possibility, is it's somewhere in between. In the first, look, this Korean War was the first war of the Cold War, the first armed conflict of the Cold War. It never ended, actually, right? We didn't win. The North Koreans didn't entirely win. We split the peninsula in half. They split the baby in half, and that's one of the reasons we're still there. Kim Jong-un, the dynastic dictator, third generation, he still wants to take over the whole country and will do so. Will do so if he has that possibility. He has developed nuclear weapons and increasingly sophisticated missiles that can deliver them, including to the U.S., while we have not been developing effective missile defense systems. That's not over. I think it is at least a possibility that the same thing happens here. The eastern part of Ukraine stays in Russian hands. The question is what happens to the south. If Putin can make Ukraine into a landlocked country, that's a way to end its existence over time. He hasn't succeeded in that yet, but he's got a big portion of the southern coast. He doesn't have Odessa, very important port, hard for him to take, but we don't know. So I can guess how this ends, but Amy, we do not know how this ends. There's no guarantee either way.
You wrote about China recently, and I took particular note of this this consortium of American business folks led by former AIG CEO Hank Greenberg that's going over to China, former trade rep Bill Cohen, former DOD sec, going over to, you know, establish better relations and figure out how we can work more constructively with the Chinese communists. It is remarkable after the last 40 years and particularly the last 4 or 5 years that guys like Greenberg and Cohen and Carla Hills just do not understand who they're dealing with. Remarkable.
Absolutely remarkable. And it's not like the evidence isn't abundant. And I also, in the column you're talking about, mentioned Christopher Wray. He's an interesting guy. He's the FBI director, as you know. He was appointed by Trump. Trump soured on him. Trump is going to fire him. Bill Barr said, you fire him, I'm resigning. Afterwards, the FBI Agents Association wrote to Biden and said, look, FBI director should be a 10-year term, kind of independent. We're asking you to do the same. So, okay. So he has some independence as a result. So he goes over to England to meet with MI5, which is more or less like the FBI over there. They've got MI5 domestic and MI6, which is more like the CIA. And what they're saying is saying some very important things. One is, look, we all, the British, the Americans, Republicans, we had a theory. The theory was we are going to embrace China. We're going to bring them into the international system, bring them into the World Trade Organization, bring them, work with them in this international. And once they get a little bit richer, they're going to want to be freer, and they're going to be partners to us in this, and stakeholders in this global world order. And what they said is, this hasn't worked out. It's quite the contrary. They want to diminish us, to humble us, to bring us down in every single way. They've been very clear about this. There's no such thing as an independent Chinese company. No such thing. They're either owned by the state or controlled by the state. They have Communist Party cells in it. There's American companies may soon, they may already have without knowing it, may soon have to officially have Communist Party cells within their companies if they're in China. They have something called civil-military fusion, which means that anything that is useful for the military must be given to the military, and the military will use that because the military's goal is to be superior, clearly superior, to the U.S., so the U.S. will not challenge. They already have a bigger navy than we do. And it's just amazing. And then these people say, well, there are like-minded people over there we can work with. But those like-minded people are not speaking out against the absolute genocide. Wonderful piece in the Wall Street Journal on this. Genocide of the Turkic Muslims of what's called Xinjiang, East Turkestan, of the colonizing and destruction of the Tibetans, what's happening to almost every other ethnic and religious minority. The people of Hong Kong had gotten used to freedoms, and they would be guaranteed freedoms under a treaty signed between the Chinese government and Britain that was violated. Now there's no freedom whatsoever left in Hong Kong. And we could just go on and on and on. And China is embarked on new imperialism in places like Africa and Latin America, by the way, where they're essentially eating America's lunch. And while all this is going on, we're saying, people need to buy electric vehicles because AOC may be right that the world will burn up in another 10 years.
Economic suicide of the West. Cliff May, president of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, foreign affairs columnist for the Washington Times as well. Cliff, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks, Annie.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Myra Flores, one of those far-right Latinas that scares the New York Times.
Conservative crazy.
Republican congressman from Rio Grande Valley in Texas.
Yeah, and at her swearing-in, Nancy Pelosi was like strong-arming her little kids. It was so weird.
Responded to Jill Biden's characterization of Mexicans as like tacos.
Oh, yeah. Breakfast tacos, Dan. It's people of San Antonio. That's what she did.
Very smart, and she offered an economic response. The price change in the ingredients of tacos from May 21st to May 22nd. Taco inflation. Tacos are unique. Ingredients may vary. Cheese plus 8.7%. Lettuce plus 11.4%. Oh, tortilla plus 12.8%. Carne asada plus 17.4%. Ooh. From May of 21 to May of 22. That's her.
I love it.
That's her asymmetrical response to the first lady and to the Biden administration, which is right on point. For more on our stagflationary economic environment, please be joined by Don Boudreau, economist, author, professor, co-director of the program on the American economy and globalization at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Don, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Good morning, as always.
We're looking at another interest rate hike from the Fed before the month is out, and we're looking at another month where we have the headlines, inflation at a 40-year high. Where do you see us trending in the near to medium term?
It's hard to predict exact amounts, but inflation, I think, is going to continue to rise. It's almost impossible to create the kind of spending power that the Fed, with encouragement from the fiscal side of D.C., the Congress and the President, injected into the economy over the past few years and not have substantial inflation. And so what the Fed's doing now, I believe, is too little, too late. I mean, it should do something. It should tighten the reins of monetary expansion. But I don't think we've seen the end of inflation. I don't think we've even seen the end of inflation's increase in its rate.
Have we seen the end of growth for the near term?
We probably have seen the end in the near term of real growth. Inflation distorts the economy. It distorts decision making. It makes it more risky to invest, particularly for the long run. And so that's going to depress real economic growth over some periods of months, perhaps even longer. So I'm not optimistic about the short term or even medium term prospects of the American economy. And of course, this is all exacerbated by the still ongoing COVID mania. Not so much here, although there's a little bit of that, but abroad in China And so the global supply sources are continuing to be clogged and obstructed and themselves distorted, all of which is going to reduce output and make it more difficult for economic growth to return to, you know, some semblance of normality.
Well, how do you suggest we get out of this if you were in charge? No, crazy question.
The best way is not to have gotten into it. There are no easy answers now. The best thing the government can do is, on the monetary side, dramatically restrict monetary growth. On the fiscal side, dramatically reduce spending, reduce borrowing. So move as close as the government possibly can to balancing its budget, although it's not going to get in any absolute sense very close. And also to do as much as possible to release the reins on entrepreneurial creativity and market flexibility. One thing that's obvious is stop this mad hostility and mad assault and battery on fossil fuels. Allow more drilling. Make it more attractive for energy companies and investors to revamp and reopen some refineries, open the pipelines. That will certainly help on the energy side. It's not a cure-all. It's not a panacea by any means. But we do what we can do, and one of the things we can do is dramatically reduce regulation, particularly in the energy sector. But of course, that's one of the many things the people in Washington are simply not going to do, because it offends their base. These people are still living in some dream la-la land that, we can have all our energy supplied by wind and solar and beetles, as opposed to the most abundant and still the best source of energy, and that's fossil fuels.
We were just talking, speaking of woozy dreamlands, we were talking to Cliff May just a little bit earlier in this hour about China and this contingent of, aged business people going over to China to try to, improve our relations or some such thing, Hank Greenberg and people like that. And one wonders what kind of posture we should take to Chinese economic interests of the Chinese communists, to be specific for clarity. There's a legislation sponsored by a congressman from South Dakota named Dusty Johnson to block foreign interests from buying U.S. ag companies, blacklisting China, Russia, North Korea, Iran, as foreign investments in American agriculture have increased by about 2.2 million acres per year since 2015. And this is sort of consistent with what you've heard over the last several years, too, about how we outsource the production of pharmaceuticals to China and so on and so forth. And this is the intersection of economic security and national security. What do you think about legislation like what Johnson is proposing, given what we know about the Chinese communists?
I'd be very skeptical of it. You and I probably disagree on this, man. I'd be very skeptical of it. I understand there are real problems with the Chinese Communist Party. The Chinese government is a tyrannical outfit. They do some horrible things. But the more we integrate with other peoples around the world, the vast majority of Chinese people are perfectly fine. They're just ruled by these thugs. And the more we economically integrate with them, one happy consequence is that they become less hostile to us. This doesn't guarantee that everything will work out well, but I think the presumption should be that Americans should be free to buy from the Chinese, that private Chinese entities should be free to invest in America and buy from America. It is what lawyers call a rebuttable presumption. If sufficient evidence in particular cases can be presented that a certain investment or a certain trade relation undermines the sufficient probability of American national security, then that's fine. Do the restriction. But I am worried about using our current problems I see a lot of it, using our current problems as an excuse to stir up further hostilities, economic hostilities, with the Chinese people. It's a difficult problem. I understand that.
Yeah.
But it's not as simple as, oh, let's just cut ties with China and everything will be fine.
No.
I think that there's a possibility of creating even more problems in the future.
Yeah, no, I mean, I hear what you're saying, and it's not that simple, but it does send a signal, and maybe this, you know, the specific language in this legislation could be more surgical, but it does send a signal that, you know, we recognize that this idea that if we liberalize relationships with China and we trade with them, that that's going to incentivize them to be more free. And in point of fact, it's difficult to argue that they haven't been more repressive since they got MFN status and we've tried this approach.
Right, but it's still the case that, you know, we're not yet belligerent with China. We don't know what would have happened if they got MFN status in 2001. We don't know what would have happened. Xi's bad news. So Xi comes to power, however
yeah.
in 2012. And we can't do the counterfactual, Dan. I don't know what would have happened otherwise. But keep this in mind. So every investment the Chinese have in America, every trade relation the Chinese have with America, it's not just us. It's not just us benefiting from these investments in trade. The Chinese benefit too. And so the greater the ties, the greater the cost to the Chinese and to the Chinese government of disrupting those ties. Again, it doesn't mean that bad things can't happen, but this problem is a great deal more complicated than a lot of people who are anti-Chinese make it out to be. And I wish the discussion were a little more sophisticated on that front.
Fair enough. I wanted to get to something else too. At the 50 laboratories of democracy level, you know, there's some increasing divide in how states manage themselves, it seems to me, in terms of the models. And Colorado is now moving towards the California, Illinois, New York camp, which is, by the way, going to be bad news for Colorado, but maybe good political news for Jared Polis in the short term, who wants to be president. They are, among other things, expanding public benefits like dental insurance, family services, biz permits, professional licenses, property tax relief benefits, and so forth to persons in this country illegally who reside in Colorado, which is the direction that those previous states have taken. And just generally what we see coming out of the pandemic, since you mentioned the pandemic, how much better economically the so-called red states are doing as compared to blue states. And I wonder, you know, if a house divided economically can stand in the long term, to borrow a phrase.
Yeah, you know, so I American federalism is not perfect. No form of federalism is perfect. But one of the silver linings that I've seen in the past 2.5 years in this other largely man-made calamity that we're suffering, there's still enough viability in American federalism to prove just what you showed. States can differ substantially from each other in the policies, and people vote with their feet, and businesses and investors vote with their dollars. And so Florida, Tennessee, Texas, they've done a lot better than certainly, you know, California and New York. And so I don't think it's a house divided so much as it's this competition among these different jurisdictions. I think it's very healthy, not perfect, but very healthy. And I would be distressed if some national government policy or Supreme Court decision came along to further reduce the amount of federalism. I think we need more of it and not less of it. You know, the irony, Dan, Amy, as you know, right, these people in California, they inflict on themselves all these horrible outcomes with their taxes and energy policies and regulatory policies. Then they get unhappy with the result. So then they move to places like Colorado and Tennessee, and then they start trying to implement the very same policies in those states.
Yeah.
That's right. Unfortunate. But
the slow learners. Yeah.
If you had one national policy.
Yeah, no,
that's why
agreed.
They say, that's
agreed.
Why their T-shirts, don't California my Utah or don't New York my Florida.
Exactly right.
Yeah, exactly.
Don Boudreau, yeah. Economist, author, professor, co-director of the program on the American economy and globalization at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, and also CafeHayek.com for Don's musings, too. Don Boudreau, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Is suicide a quiet epidemic among first responders in this country, and maybe particularly in the city of Chicago? The question deserves a revisiting because of the three suicides. I guess one isn't it still in the attempted.
He passed away.
He pass away?
It was a sergeant. And
over this weekend.
Yeah, over the weekend.
So three in the last 2 weeks. I guess the question needs a revisiting. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line.
First, you had Patsy. She'd killed her, Patsy Swink, 29 years old, killed herself July 2nd. And her family spoke with NBC5 last night to talk about, you know, they didn't know that she was hurting. The night before she died, she gave her mother, she sent her mother a clip of her holding a four-month-old baby who just lost his mother to in a homicide. So they were pretty surprised.
She loved being a police officer, and she dedicated her life to serving other people. I wish she would have spoke up, but that's just the kind of person she was. She didn't want to bother anyone else or be a burden to anyone else. She always cared about what was going on in your life and what was going on with you. And that just showed the heart she had.
And Mayor Lightfoot, who's, you know, she's been in Paris and she's been overseas, she finally acknowledged what's going on and said, please know that we're here, that we hear you, and we're working tirelessly to ease the mental and physical burden on our police officers. But how is she doing? And she's not doing that. And then she tweeted out a phone number you can call, guys, if you're feeling suicidal. But the problem is they are working 12-hour shifts, and there's no day off in sight. So when would they even have time for counseling? Here's Patsy's brother.
I'm not denying that there are resources, but when you give someone resources, they're supposed to be able to use them. How are you supposed to use these resources when you're working 12-hour days with no days off? There's no time. There's been now three officers in the last 2 weeks, and I don't see any officials doing anything about it.
Well, it's a difficult topic, but all of these are individual cases with their own particular variables, their own characteristics, right? They're three different people and three different families living three different lives, and they committed suicide, and it's an issue. I agree that it's an issue. And particularly in Chicago, there was a report we mentioned around the 4th of July that from 2017 that the Justice Department found that the Chicago Police Department's suicide rate was 60% higher than the national average for police officers. And police officers, not the number one job, not the number one profession in terms of incidents of suicide as compared to the general population. There are other professions that have higher per capita suicide rates as compared to the overall rate, construction industry and others. So it's not to minimize what's going on with police and what's going on with Chicago police specifically, but understand that because of the nature of their jobs, its profile, it's in the media. We talk about this for good reason. And they're in the spotlight in a way that a lot of other professions are not. So it's just different.
In construction, where there wasn't a defund construction workers movement. I mean, this McNally's Bar in Mount Greenman, they put up a sign. Democrats started defund police in 2020. And now here we are in 2022.
Yeah. I mean, I appreciate the sign and I appreciate the problem. But of course, you have 12,000 Chicago police. So different people, as we were talking about with Uvalde, have an ability to cope at different levels. And There are a lot of other people that are working those 12-hour shifts 30 days in a row that are coping. It's not blaming, it's describing. So it's always so much more complicated than a data point or a do something or throw resources at it. Individual cases, individual dynamics, different situations for each and every one of the officers.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. 42-year-old Duren Lee committed suicide on Friday, and then yesterday a sergeant committed suicide, and his nephew tweeted out, absolutely true, my uncle Christopher served with the LAPD before moving to join you all in Chicago, where he gave his all to serve and protect his community, all without praise or gratitude. He sadly passed away after committing suicide from the stress of his job. That's what that family saying, that he was so stressed because of no days off. Felt like nobody has their back. I mean, where's Superintendent Brown? Where's Mayor Lightfoot? I mean, Mayor Lightfoot has a press conference at 10 o'clock today. Superintendent Brown is going to have one at 9, where he's going to read the same thing that he did after Patsy Swank committed suicide. This unemotional, unheartfelt response, I'm sure, saying, you know, this is a problem, but they need to fix the problem. Their officers are saying there's stress on the job. Well, when they go to work, besides the fact that they die, they make the wrong decision in a split second, and they're tired, and they're exhausted, then they could lose their pension, they could lose their livelihood, they could go to jail. Construction workers don't face that. I don't know of any other profession that is got to be as stressed out as they are. And News Affairs asking, when you see a cop, you know, smile and say hi to them.
Well, again, pleasant. These other professions have higher suicide rates, and so it's just the data.
Right.
Read into it what you want. Construction workers don't have some stresses that police do, and apparently they have other stresses, or there are more people that have a more difficult time coping. This is not a linear. Right. This is not a problem with a linear solution. In point of fact, mining, oil and gas extraction, construction, ag, forestry, fishing, hunting, transportation, and warehousing. These are all groups that have a higher incidence of suicide than the general population, and then protective services, which includes police, prison, firefighters, and others. So it's complicated. But, yeah, obviously, generally speaking, the idea that the civilian authorities backing the police, that you have enough police on the job to do the job so that you don't have people being overextended, that would clearly help everybody, whether regardless of their coping skills, if you will. The other thing, too, is the other side of the house, the prosecution side, feeling like
no one has your back, or
not feeling like you're Sisyphus here when you arrest these violent criminals and then you see them turn right back around on the streets committing
Sisyphus.
Another acts of violence.
Common spelling? Sisyphus? Sorry. Okay.
Pushing the rock up the hill only to watch it roll back down
exactly.
In perpetuity. So Marilyn Mosby. Remember Marilyn Mosby? Speaking of cops and the relationship with prosecutors. She's the city prosecuting attorney in Baltimore, which is also a town that's completely given over to predators. And she doesn't like the way that she's been treated in the media by the local Fox affiliate. So as Baltimore is careening towards 300-plus murders for the eighth straight year, which is essentially the equivalent of Chicago being around 800 murders like we were last year. In other words, 30-year highs. She took the time to make this completely tone-deaf parody video that she tweeted out.
When did she do this?
This is a prosecutor. This is your local prosecutor.
Do we really want to hear
who is another Soros-funded non-prosecution decarceration prosecutor. And you've had many generations of politicians in that office and in the mayor's office who've presided over the decimation of Baltimore. Sound familiar? Here's the video. Spoof video of the local Fox affiliate covering City Hall, in particular Marilyn Mosby.
Stay tuned. The Fix is in.
You're watching Fix 45.
Instead of Fox 45, Fix 45.
Yeah.
This is Lakeith Danielson from Fix 45. I'm standing right outside of the campaign headquarters for State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby. As you can see, her campaign office is right here behind me. And I have some shocking developments that was just uncovered by our Baltimore Project investigative team. These new details will absolutely blow you away. On March 28th, 1984, the owner of the once mighty Baltimore Colts moved the team to Indianapolis in the middle of the night. While we all remember the heartbreaking footage of the Mayflower trucks pulling out of town, no one can account for the whereabouts of future Baltimore State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby. No one can account for the whereabouts of future state's attorney Marilyn Mosby, and many are actually questioning whether or not she was one of the getaway drivers and if she masterminded the entire ordeal. When I reached out to Ms. Mosby's office for a comment, her spokesperson said that state's attorney Marilyn Mosby was only 4 years old at the time, not a direct denial of her involvement. Sir?
Baltimore Colts fan?
Yeah. Sure. Are you a Baltimore Colts fan?
Yeah.
So what do you what do you say about the fact that people are saying that it's because of Marilyn Mosby's policies that the Baltimore Colts had left?
I don't know nothing about that, man. I don't even know. She wasn't even in the office working in Baltimore when the Colts left here. That was past to the year 2000. Baltimore Colts?
Yeah, some are saying because of her.
Oh, boy. Marilyn Mosby tweeted that out. You know.
I'm glad she's having such a good time with all this.
Yeah, we don't
know. Death and mayhem, people getting robbed, carjacked. This is fun.
We don't know anything about that in a city lorded over by the Rona Busters, do we? It's fun. It's cosplay for Marilyn Mosby and Lori Lightfoot.
Everyone's having
and your buddy, Dr. Arwadi.
Everyone's having a good time.
I mean, it's a remarkable how untalented they are.
Why would she tweet that?
In addition to cynical. Oh. Untalented.
Oh. I'm watching it right now. It's cringy. I can't.
Mike in Melrose Park.
Hey, good morning, guys. You know, a few years ago, I knew a woman that was a nurse, and she used to do 12-hour shifts. And she was telling me that, I don't know if it was her union or the hospitals or whatever, but they could not do consecutive 12s because whoever felt that they were not equipped to do that, just because it's such a drain on you.
Right.
If you work 12 and then have 12 to recuperate, sleep, do your chore, you know, your daily chores, whatever, and that was not conducive to taking care of patients. And it seems like the same thing with cops would say, you know, split second decisions and whatnot. So that's just something I wanted to add.
Thanks, Mike. Appreciate it. Don on the north side.
Hello.
Hey, Don.
Yes. I'd like to comment regarding the police suicide situation. Generally speaking, in most professions, this does not happen. But in the police department, when you become a recruit or a candidate to become a recruit, you go through a battery of tests, polygraph, for example, background investigation, and you go through a psychological background. So if the psychological backgrounds at the beginning of your police career identify you as a normal, average person that would be suitable to become a police officer, you continue through that process all the way through graduating the academy and then ultimately coming out on the street.
I think that's a very important point, because if all things are being equal and you have a good quality recruitment program to include the psychological evaluation, then generally speaking, those candidates going through the academy should be successful in terms of psychological issues. And if they do have psychological issues, then they should be removed from the department. So the job itself creates an enormous amount of pressure, both in service to the community, in the protection of yourself and your partner, for example, making, as somebody else mentioned, split-second decisions.
Yep.
And being, you know, most people have families, and this becomes extraordinarily difficult for them. My thoughts, my feelings on this thing, this is a design by Lightfoot and her ilk to weaken the police department to the point where they become nearly ineffective. And I think we're pretty close to that. If you watch what's going on the city streets, which you do, this is not a safe city. I don't care what the mayor says. The mayor is doing this by design, cleverly, I might add.
But then who would take over?
People in the city of Chicago are going along with this thing. And you know what? They deserve the police that they get. If this is what they want, and they want to put this extraordinary pressure on the citizens of Chicago as well as their police department, then you take a look every day, and especially on these weekends. This is Murder City, and this falls right at the foot of the fifth floor, and Mayor Lightfoot.
Thanks for the call, Don. Well, two things. One is, yeah, you're right. I'm sure glad they don't do psych evals to be a radio talk show host. I agree with that. So it is different. Number two, though, I mean, there is in a corporate setting, as I'm sure you know, I'm sure a lot of people know. I mean, there are tests that are done depending on the job. I mean, cognitive ability tests like the Wunderlich test, but also there are a lot of corporations that do something akin to a psych eval. But I mean, I appreciate the point. I mean, it does pre-qualify the officers that are going to be on the street. So you're dealing, as opposed to the general population, you're dealing with sort of a pre-qualified, a well-adjusted group based on the screening that's done. That is a fair point.
It's like they're going to war every day. I mean, again, over this weekend with that, you know, the donuts that they were doing at the corner of Monroe and Clinton, the cops responded and somebody opened up the door and threw a firecracker in there again.
Right.
There is zero lack of respect for police officers.
Although maybe that's just a precursor to us doing an F1 race in the city of Chicago like they had in Miami this year.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe it's some amateur F1 drivers there at Monroe and Clinton. Or maybe we do did you ever see that Jason Statham movie, Death Race?
Did not see that one.
Yeah. Maybe we start to do that.
I saw Baby Driver.
Yeah, okay. Some similarities.
But yeah, no, they are going to have races in the city of the Chicago, like legal races.
Joe, Arlington Heights. Well, they want to bring NASCAR here.
Right, NASCAR, yeah.
Yeah, but I'm thinking F1. All right, Joe, Arlington Heights.
Good morning. You know, there's a theme that's running through today's discussions, whether it's the rage of kids in the city or whether or not it's shooters or whether or not it's people suicide. A lot of society's ills, I think, boil down to hopelessness.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when somebody has no hope in the future, it manifests itself in very many sad ways that, you know, people hurt themselves or hurt others.
Mm-hmm.
And as a society, we need to look at how to make better citizens. And part of that is by giving people hope, not telling them their country is racist or that we're killing the planet or there are no boys and there are no girls or there's no God. There's a need in the human spirit, in human existence, to love each other and to love God. And if we don't do that, if we don't build a society that does that, if we don't have institutions that do that, people begin to lose hope. And unfortunately, we're seeing a manifestation of that. What do you think, Dan?
I say amen to that, Joe. Thanks.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
the morning, Dan and Amy. According to Gallup, only 28% of Americans say they have a great deal or quite a lot of trust in the country's public school systems. That is just a little bit above the record low from 2014 of 26%. 28%, just over 1 in 4 Americans, only 1 in 4 Americans say they have a great deal of trust in the country's public school systems. That's down from 41%. It was never great, but that's down from 41% in 2020. You know, you see this, so before the pandemic, so it's declined significantly since the pandemic for all kinds of obvious reasons. But you see this and you say, oh, well, finally there is an appetite for system change. But you don't really get it where you need it most, do you? You have Betsy DeVos now saying we should abolish the Department of Education. And something that's been kicked around for generations as well, former Secretary of Education. You know, it would have been nice to see. I think she did a good job generally, but it would be nice to see for while she was in that post talking about taking the $45 billion of DOE budget and saying, let's just turn it all into opportunity scholarships and keep a couple of staffers around to administer the transfer payments, and that's about it. You just don't, you see people lose faith in an institution and you don't see the institution change. Not systemically make structural changes. You see the continued advance of choice in terms of charter schools. You see enough power with the school choice and charter school movement to defang some of the regulations that were to be promulgated by the Biden administration regulating charter schools and the federal funds that they receive throughout as part of the overall drop shipping of federal dollars to states and localities for some revenue for the local school districts. Like CPS, Chicago Public Schools, receives about 10% of its budget from the federal government, based on poverty levels and so on, for free and reduced school lunch kids and so on and so forth. But just that dynamic of complete loss of faith at the institution, yet so much inertia that it's difficult to make those structural changes that would perhaps inspire, if not confidence, at least hope that you could have confidence in the not too distant future. To help us understand that, pleased to be joined by Charles Love, Executive Director of Seeking Educational Excellence, author of Race Crazy, BLM 1619, and the Progressive Racism Movement. Charles, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Great to be here. Too long. How have you been?
Good. Good to have you back. And so what do you make of that? You know, 3 in 4 Americans don't have confidence in the government schools. You don't see, particularly in urban centers, much give from the teachers' union-dominated government schools.
Well, I'm shocked by it. I mean, obviously they know best. I don't know why they wouldn't trust them. I mean, to the Department of Education, that's so unfair to them. I mean, they need the $45 billion. First of all, how are you going to build a school? Oh, wait, they don't use the money for that. Okay, books. What about ordering? Oh, they don't use the money for that either, huh? What are we giving them $45 billion for then? I wonder. No, it's evident that people, all they had to do was open their eyes. I think the issue was that they weren't paying attention. Still not enough of them do. But if you just open your eyes, you'll see it, right? I was just talking to somebody, not even just our politicians. Think about COVID. We had people who just buy into whatever the government tells us, saying, you need to stay in the house and we need to shut everything down because that's the right thing to do. And I stand with here in New York. I stand with the governor. I stand with the mayor. And then they went and they opened businesses in evil Florida and they made their money. So, like, you know, I'll say this, but what I'm actually going to do is do what's best for me. So all you got to do is open your eyes. All around you, there are people showing you that the system is not helping you. But unfortunately, we don't have enough people paying attention. I think that is the problem. And then, like you say, when you do speak up, they just pat you on the head and say, no, we know better.
And I read this article over the weekend, New York Post, saying that New York City public schools on track to lose 30,000 students by this fall. And do you think that's roughly, or, you know, the reasoning behind it is because of the pandemic or because of there's no teaching in the classrooms?
Amy, take your pick. They give you a smorgasbord of reasons not to go to their schools. They say, okay, we're going to mask your kids, even though it makes no sense. Eric Adams just hinted that I might just force the mandate on the kids before people leave. And then I don't know what it's – supposedly he would replace him with someone better, but I got an email bragging about – everybody talks about this CRT or whatever they're teaching, whatever you want to call it, saying it's not happening. But he has to brag about it. They send an email and they say – exciting news. Come the fall, we're going to teach all the kids culturally relevant math and English because, you know, the black kids can't learn math and English the same way as the white kids. You got to teach them the black math. So, of course, they're going to say this is too much. Everything they're doing says don't send your kids here, right? They're putting big signs up outside. So, yeah, people are leaving in droves.
And this effort by the Biden administration to co-opt the parents' revolt, we talked about it a bit. The Department of Education announcing this National Parents and Families Engagement Council, appropriately Orwellian, to make policy recommendations to help families constructively engage at the local level. Like you need a federal facilitator to go to a school board meeting and engage with your school. But they've got Al Sharpton and other representatives of the left that are on this commission within the Department of Education. And there's some pushback, thankfully, from Parents Defending Education about the stilted nature of this committee. But the good news from all that is, forget the silly council and the members that make it up. The good news is if the parents' revolt wasn't real, they wouldn't be standing up this committee within DOE. They wouldn't be trying to insinuate themselves between parents and school boards.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, they are making a difference. They're making an impact. We hear, although you talked about Parents Defending Ed and Nicole Neely's group, but you got Moms for Liberty, you got No Left Turns in Education, you got Parents Unite. So there's lots of organizations and lots of people waking up to what's happening, and which is why they're scared. And you made a good point when you said Orwellian. It's funny how all these things, you got to just sit back and sometimes just chuckle, because all these organizations, they come up, they have the most wonderful, warm, soft feeling names. They feel good. It makes me want to join when they come up.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And they're always the opposite of what it is, right? Always. But it also goes back to the budget, right? They got this money to spend. They don't do anything of merit with it, so they got to spend it somewhere. Why not give it to Al? Al knows best. It's crazy. But yeah, you're right. That it means that they're fighting against something, so it must be working.
Something else I wanted to address with you. We mentioned your name when we tackled the topic last week, but you were one of the signatories on this letter calling out those who were engaging in the nastiest, most vile, most racist rhetoric in the direction of Clarence Thomas because they disagree with him and others on the Supreme Court. For some reason, they zero in on him, but... You know, that Dobbs decision was not Clarence Thomas 1 and the rest of the Supreme Court 0. It was a 6-3 decision. Anyway.
Yeah, they didn't like the opinion.
The Uncle Tom and worse in the direction of Clarence Thomas. And you got people from across the spectrum, which was nice. Black leaders, academics and professionals from across the spectrum. Some who agree with Thomas's jurisprudence, some who don't. That said, you don't get to kick... white liberals, you don't get to kick Clarence Thomas out of the black community because you don't like the decision in Dobbs.
Oh, yeah. I think it was really important to do that, and people needed to understand that no one should be – I mean, we always say the first one who starts calling names loses the debate, right? So if you're going to say, well, the first thing I have to say is that he's an Uncle Tom, start calling him names, that's an issue. But you have to point out, in this case, the white progressives. Some say, well, why are we playing their game and using their terms? But we have gotten with cancel culture to the point that whites were uncomfortable in their racism, right? They still existed, but like, I'd never say that in public. The culture wouldn't allow me to. But somehow, with this certain type of black person, they felt emboldened that they could just go on. And what bothered me the most was I saw people typing full-on the N-word, right, on social media, Instagram, things of that nature, not getting banned. You know, we talk about the things you can't say. So apparently if it comes from the right person, it doesn't go against their standards, right? But what's interesting to me is that the black people who speak the most about that, who live in the terms of race, everything, the Ukraine is racist, milk is racist, all they talk about is racist, yet they saw that and they're like, So it's not only the fact that they were emboldened to do it, which is odd, right, shows their true colors, but the fact that all these people who live on race, who make millions of dollars and stand on piles of money that they built, a house built on money from racism, just were like, yeah, that's not too bad. Yeah, I don't see anything wrong with it. So the fact that they're silent proves that they don't really mean it. They don't have a problem with racism because it doesn't get any more open than that, and they were okay with it.
Now, you moved from Chicago to New York a while ago, and just wanted to check in.
Talk about a lateral move.
I know. I thought not a lot of difference when it comes to crime and homicide rate. But how is your progressive district attorney, Alvin Bragg, doing?
Bragg, well, hey, if I want to say one nice thing about Bragg, is he did what he said he was going to do. Some people are outraged. Obviously, you've heard about Mr. Alba and, the murderer on Rikers because, you know, he's killing people or defending himself. And, you know, he's doing a terrible job, but he's doing the job he told people he was going to do. What struck me most about that case, though, was, you know, let's take the picture for you. You have a DA like that there, too. So he ran on bail reform. The bail reform DA, right? Mm-hmm. Cash bail is bad. Who's going to let the people out of prison because we shouldn't lock people up. Wants to lock a guy up who was defending himself on video so we can see it. But what people miss is he asked for, everybody talked about the $250,000 was high. He asked for $500,000. The judge only gave him $250,000. So bail reform guy wanted to give the innocent guy who was working his job trying to defend himself and he stabbed an 8-time criminal who was out for attacking the police who arrested him, wanted to give him $500,000 bail. So what does that tell you?
Well, what is it? You know, I guess I already know Alvin Bragg is a known quantity, so I know what he's doing. What you're still trying to get a handle on, do you see real movement within particular neighborhoods, particular demographics on the issue of public safety in New York City and elsewhere? I mean, we saw this police-involved shooting in Minneapolis. You had the same sort of pro forma. By the way, he shot and almost killed his neighbor. He shot at police when they arrived. Police shot and killed him. And somehow this is, another instance of police abuse and so forth. You just wonder if there is a attenuation of the power of the Black Lives movement, of the race identity politics, of I'm going to vote for the black guy because I'm black, I'm going to vote for the Latino guy because I'm Latino, that kind of business. Is that continuing to lose a currency, do you think?
I think it is, not fast enough. I think it goes back to where we started our conversation. If people open their eyes, here's a quick example. So you got the guy that was shot. You know, they shot him 60 times, regardless of what he did. You shouldn't have shot him 60 times. We're hitting the streets. Yet, I don't know if you even know this story. 2 weeks ago here in New York, a guy calls up and says, I'm going to kill the governor. I'm going to kill the mayor. I'm crazy. Come get me. So they show up. They get into a shootout. They shoot him 100 times, right? Wow. He's not white. Nobody hit the streets. It's because, you know, there is no Black Lives Matter, no Hispanic Lives Matter organization, and he was an Hispanic guy. So you look at, so to the races, they look at the guy, they see a guy with brown skin, they see he got shot 100 times by the police. Why don't we have the same outrage? Because it's phony outrage. So all people have to do is open their eyes. It's like George Floyd, with all these other situations, no matter how bad they are, there is an equal and opposite white guy who was treated the same way and no one knows about it, right? So if it was really police outrage, if you really wanted to change, and in some cases you do need to improve what the police do, but the best way to do it is say, here's all the cases where the police did X. It proves that there's a problem, let's fix it. But if you just say, no, just give me the three worst ones where the person was black and let's look at those, then you lose all your merit. And so I think that it's still happening, but they are moving away from it. People are starting to see the money thing helped, but it's just, and the people who were in the group leaving, but it's just going to be a slow thing because we're still so focused on race. We're still race crazy.
Charles Love, Executive Director of Seeking Educational Excellence, author of the aforesaid Race Crazy, BLM 6019 and the Progressive Racism Movement. Charles, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper. Hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.